continued protests over IU's vaccine policy, Indiana's new Secretary of Commerce, plus Scott County ending its needle exchange, and more on Indiana Week in Review, for the week ending June 11th, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, conservative groups continue to protest Indiana University's COVID-19 vaccination policy, despite the university recently backing down from its mandate that students, faculty, and staff show proof of vaccination. Dozens of state lawmakers and Indiana Attorney General Todd Rokita argued a new state law barred IU from requiring proof of COVID-19 vaccination. The university then amended its policy, incentivizing but not requiring that proof. Still, the university is mandating that students, faculty, and staff get the vaccine with limited religious and medical exemptions. But some are still protesting the policy, including a literal protest in Bloomington this week, and prominent conservative attorney Jim Bopp is threatening a lawsuit, claiming IU's program is unconstitutional. Will the legislature act on IU's vaccination policy? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Ann Delaney. Republican, Jennifer Hollowell. Eric Berman, WIBC State House Bureau Chief. And Lindsay Erdody, WFYI Digital Editor for Health and Education. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, we recently asked on the show if IU's vaccination policy would last until the fall term. It didn't quite. But will the change that the university made forestall a legislative response?
I hope so. I hope the legislature, and particularly the leadership in the legislature, says, okay, they made a compromise, leave it alone. I mean, this is all about protecting Hoosiers. There's already a religious exception for vaccinations of all kinds, and people who are religiously opposed to having vaccines can use that exception. But it's about keeping Hoosiers safe. And I frankly thought that IU's policy was the right policy before they backtracked. So I think the legislature ought not to play doctor and ought to stay out of it. And I'm hoping that's what they're going
to
do.
The legislative responses to IU's policy were focused on the newly passed law and you can't show proof and all that. Well, IU's now backed off of that. I imagine there are still some lawmakers who don't like the word requirement and vaccine together at all. But does this prevent any legislative response at least before the next regular session in 2022?
I'm not sure. I haven't heard anything about any additional action just yet, but I do think that this kind of modification is not sitting well with a lot of people because essentially I think what they're doing is knowingly encouraging students to lie because they're still asking them to sign, they have to sign a form saying that they were vaccinated, they just don't have to show proof of it, right? And so my choice is, if I don't want to be vaccinated for whatever reason, maybe I had COVID and a doctor told me that I shouldn't get a vaccine yet, so I'm supposed to check a box and lie if I want to go to that school. I think it's problematic, but I don't know whether we'll see any sort of action before school starts.
It struck me when IU said, okay, we won't require proof, but we're going to make you do this and just say that you did it, felt a little like a mask mandate that we're not going to enforce that happened in the state. So is this, to Jennifer's point, is IU's change in policy just asking people to lie to them?
It's inviting people to lie to them, I suppose. It's not really asking them to. And, you know, they do have the incentive attached, which is surprisingly effective. You wouldn't think that the chance to be in a drawing would make people more willing to get a vaccine than the prospect of being immune to a deadly virus. But we've seen in Ohio and other places that, in fact, it is effective. So maybe it will have an impact. I'm not sure it's going to encourage people to lie, but it certainly opens the door for it.
I should say, in full disclosure, I didn't say this the last time we talked about this because I kind of forget this sometimes. But due to my kind of weird employment situation with Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm technically an IU employee. So
good.
I was very happy to show
good
proof
thing,
and get
good
the
thing you were vaccinated.
And get the incentive. I hope I win something. But Lindsay, in terms of legislative response, I'm sure there are still lawmakers who don't like this. But will they address it this calendar year?
It's a good question, and I think to Jenner's point, I don't know. They might.
talk about it again. They might try to clarify what they meant in the law that they passed, because clearly some of them think that they meant that IU could not do this. Some of them say, no, IU should be able to do this. I think going back to that discussion, though, kind of opens this can of worms of, do we do a stronger ban on vaccination requirements? I mean, because IU is not the only large institution in the state that is doing this. Notre Dame is, Community Health, IU Health. Mm-hmm. So, yes, IU is the only state university doing this right now, but I think the discussion would get a lot wider if they did bring it back up this year.
One point on that, too, though. What happens if the federal government comes back in and instead of having temporary approval, gives final approval? What I've heard from a lot of people is it's been rushed through, it's not a final and all. What happens then?
But I think because that's different because all these organizations that say we already require vaccines, but they're not emergency youth authorization.
Okay, so then, they, so then the legislature would back off.
I think it changes.
Which
it.
May happen before the end of the year.
I want to follow up just on that with you, which is this idea of, because the lawmakers' letters, a lot of people pointed to the EUA that all of the vaccines are under right now as the reason why no one should be requiring it. But let's be honest, given how politicized COVID-19 has been, and frankly the vaccine on both sides, because you have some Republicans are saying, look what Trump gave us, and of course Democrats are saying, no, it's Biden who gave us this, but given the politicization,
I think the doctors gave it to
well,
us,
yeah,
but,
I agree with that too. Will it matter, quite frankly, whether it's an EUA or full approval?
I don't think so. I think it changes the rhetoric, but not the argument. The opponents, and for that matter, the supporters, but they are starting with a position, and particularly in the case of the opponents, they're looking for, and here's how we back that up. It comes down to, you can't tell me what to do. EUA and religious exemptions and the other stuff that flies around in support of that, I think, is more trying to justify that basic position.
So do we go back and say that polio is not required and smallpox isn't required and all of these things for institutions? We go back to having pandemics every year?
Well, and that's the thing. The law they wrote only applies to the COVID-19 vaccine.
But the principle, the argument does.
Yeah.
I mean, if it isn't the fact that it's temporary, then the argument goes out the window, and it's against all vaccines.
If they make a, you know, valid argument.
Well, they aren't making a valid argument now, but that doesn't stop them from passing legislation.
Well, nothing stops them from passing legislation.
Well, there's no question
about that. Indiana has a new Secretary of Commerce. The governor announced this week, Brad Chambers, will lead the state's Economic Development Agency. Chambers is the founder and CEO of Indianapolis-based Buckingham Companies, which invests, develops, and manages primarily housing properties. In a statement, Governor Eric Holcomb called Chambers a transformational leader and says no one is better suited to head up the Indiana Economic Development Corporation. Chambers will lead the state's ongoing efforts to attract more businesses to Indiana and encourage companies here to grow, often through financial incentives. Chambers will not leave his company. He will remain in leadership at Buckingham while reducing his day-to-day role. The company will not be eligible for state incentives while Chambers leads the IEDC. Jennifer Hollowell, should Hoosiers be uncomfortable with Chambers leading the IEDC and his private company at the same time?
Not at all. And first, I think that this is a great selection by Governor Holcomb. So I'm really excited about it. I'm excited to see what direction he takes the agency. There are a lot of big things, I think, on the horizon for IEDC and a lot of big projects that they're getting ready to start with the Ready Grants and everything else. But no, I don't think so at all, because the key point is his company is not going to be eligible for state incentives or any sort of special treatment. But, you know, we want the best and brightest and people who have solid experience running these agencies. And so you're going to find people who are running companies and have private interests. They either need some time to wind down or have some sort of, you know, separation from that works. And in this case, I think they're doing it the right way. And his focus is going to be IEDC, but he's not going to be completely separated from, you know, the company that he has run.
Dr. Chris Box, the head of the State Department of Health, also practices medicine. Dr. Sullivan, also Jennifer Sullivan, who runs FSSA, she's also still a practicing physician. Uh-huh. Is this really a big deal?
Well, I don't think it's a big deal for him to be part-time. I mean, they don't do anything, so it doesn't matter. They don't need a lot of time.
I think they do a lot.
I don't actually think they do. They attract low-paying jobs because the taxes are low here. They don't, I assume they market our universities, but they don't support them. You know, it's whatever just happens to come here. And then they come up with an alphabet soup kind of proposal, which they reinvent every either budget cycle or every other budget cycle, the same kind of program with a different name. I don't think it matters that he's part-time because I don't think that the Department of Commerce is doing anything meaningful for the growth of Indiana.
It doesn't matter because it's okay. It doesn't matter because the agency doesn't do anything.
Right.
So you got to the same answer.
You got
really
to the same answer.
That.
There you go.
Should Hoosiers care that he's still going to be working for his company?
I think they should care a little bit because the IDC cannot give his company incentives while he is in that role. We know that. That is a really easy thing for watchdogs to check. But keep in mind what other incentives are going to be given out to companies that might, as an aside, benefit his company. You know, he is an Indiana businessman.
Or competitors of his company.
Well, right, that might hurt his company that don't get incentives. You know, just some of this, like, indirect situations that he might find himself in, I think, is going to be something to watch, and I think it's going to be something that's a little difficult to watch in real time.
I don't think there's any reason not to give Brad Chambers the benefit of the doubt that he will do this the right way. But are you just inviting all of these questions that you don't need to invite?
You literally took the words right out of my mouth. There's going to be scrutiny that you would not have without that situation. Is it inherently a problem? No. If they follow what they've laid out and said he won't be involved in any day-to-day business, or won't be involved in anything that affects the company, rather, probably works out fine. But it definitely invites the kind of scrutiny that you and Lindsay both described.
I would also say it's still unclear how much he's pulling back or what pulling back looks like. We heard some comments from him this week that, you know, he's slowly pulling back, but he is still really involved right now. And so, like, what does that actually look like, and when are you fully pulled back?
Yeah, I think the official line was reducing his day-to-day involvement. Well, reducing it to zero, reducing it to what?
Like, I guess we'll find out. You know, he could do, if he really wanted to serve and really had some ideas that were different from the ones we've regurgitated, he could do as Mickey Maurer did and do it for a dollar a year because he's supposed to be a successful entrepreneur and he could save the state money and do it full time.
Would that solve those sort of questions?
I think it would.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Icemiller email and text alerts. This week's question, should Indiana's new Secretary of Commerce also keep his leadership role at the private company he founded? A, yes, or B, no. Last week, we asked you if Indiana University should require the COVID-19 vaccine for all students, faculty, and staff with those limited religious and medical exemptions. We got a huge spike in responses, predominantly saying no, IU shouldn't have that requirement, with just 23% saying yes compared to that 76% no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Indiana's first ever needle exchange is going to close at the end of this year. Scott County's program, created in 2015 under then-Governor Mike Pence, has been credited with slowing the severe HIV outbreak there. But after years of falling cases, the county commissioners felt it was time to end the program. County Commissioners President Mike Jones, who voted to end the program, said he believes the needle exchange was leading to more overdoses, which remain an issue in the rural Hoosier County. County Health Administrator Michelle Matern says odds are the move will send the county in the wrong direction when it comes to new cases of HIV and hepatitis C.
It's very, very likely, and the, you know, experts from all over the world tell us, you know, this is probably going to, you know, be another outbreak without a certain service program.
The commissioners say they can reinstate the needle exchange program at a later date if HIV cases spike again, but health officials say at that point it'd probably be too late. Eric Berman, the HIV and hepatitis outbreak in 2015 didn't just have an effect inside Scott County. We saw it trickle to other parts of the state, not just in that region, but up and down the interstate. Should Hoosiers be worried that we're headed back to something like that?
Here's a firm answer. I don't know. I think the big surprise about the needle exchange program is that it hasn't been more widespread. You know, the Governor Holcomb pushed through the bill that allowed any county to do this. It's not a state mandate, but any county can do it. We've got 9. After Scott County's ends, it'll be 8. So that's...
And several of them are almost constantly having battles at the local level about whether or not to keep them open.
Yeah, Madison County just renewed after going into limbo for a little while. It's not been without controversy. The irony here is that Scott County is pulling out not just as the county that started it all, but pulling out at the exact time that the legislature seemed to be coming around to this. They passed an extension this year with virtually no debate over it. There was a huge debate last year. This year, yeah, we're good. 4 more years.
And it was a lengthier extension than they've been willing to do in the past.
Exactly. So the theory from the supporters of this was, okay, the people are finally seeing the benefit. It's not really about the needles. It's about the other health services you can connect them to. But there are skeptics at the county level. In terms of, does it affect health? Well, 83 counties have so far gotten by. The thing about a virus is you don't know where it's going to pop up, but I don't know that this necessarily sets off alarm bells across 83 counties.
The folks who spoke in Scott County over the last few weeks as this debate was coming to a head, I mean, the sheriff who had run opposed to needle exchanges had come around to it and testified in support of them. The vast majority of the community came out and testified in support. You didn't have a lot of people coming, at least publicly, to say, no, we got to shut this down, even though clearly that is a sentiment there. So, but are you, because of that, are you a little surprised that this went the way it did?
A little bit, yes, but clearly there is an argument going on still, even after, you know, seeing that bill go through this year to extend the program, an argument of, does this work? Is it effective? Should we continue it? And maybe that's happening more on the local level than at the state level at this time, but it's also happening in other states that they're having these discussions, adding more requirements to needle exchange programs. You know, I think the surprising thing to me was how many health professionals, health experts came out and said, this is a bad idea, you need to keep this. Like people, you know, business leaders in that community who are well respected, and then they still voted to end it.
If you're in one of these relatively few other counties that has a needle exchange, if you look, the first county that ever got one of these in Indiana, the reason we're allowed to have needle exchanges right. In Indiana, and even they said it's time to stop.
Yeah, I'm not. The healthcare professionals are the ones I'd follow on this. I mean, obviously Scott County had a problem, had a serious problem, had national attention drawn to Scott County, and then they stepped in and they did something about it to their credit. And to the state's credit, we actually started to deal with that problem. To pull back now, it just doesn't make any sense to me. They're on the interstate, and they have those truck stops, and that's where the problems were. And I'd like to believe that we've gone beyond that, and we're not going to have the problem again, but I don't believe it. And I just think it was a lack of foresight on their part.
Commissioners President Jones, in that public meeting where they had the vote, said something to the effect of, and I'm not going to get the quote exactly right, but it was, he was citing the concern about the continued high number of overdoses, and he said, I'm not going to buy an alcoholic a case of beer. I'm not going to give a drug addict a needle. That's the way that opponents have often looked at this. But that's not really what needle exchanges are about.
No.
Is that just a fundamental, we can't bridge that divide?
I don't know about that. I mean, I do think, as you mentioned, I mean, this was one of Governor Holcomb's first bill signings, right? So it's obviously an important issue to the state. But we have local elected officials for a reason, and they'll be held accountable. So if the majority of folks in the community are opposed to this, then you may see something come from that. But I do also believe that the county health officials are going to be watching this incredibly closely. And if the trend line starts to move in the wrong direction, then I think they can reinstate it.
I hope so.
When it comes to, you know, we haven't heard a lot about the opioid crisis in a while. There's been another health crisis that we've had on our minds.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
But, yeah, I'm looking for coverage. It's still out there. I don't think Eric Holcomb thinks the opioid crisis is over. I don't think Doug Hunsinger, the drug czar, thinks that it's over. There's still opioid addiction out there. And the question is, with all the actions the state has taken over these last few years trying to get it under control, trying to build more treatment options and so forth, how far have you gone? Because if you've still got lots and lots of people who are using needles and sharing needles, you're going to have a problem. If you're starting to put a dent in the opioid issue, then maybe you get by with this.
And not only is the opioid epidemic still here, there is some evidence to suggest it was made worse during the pandemic as people were cut off from services, they were home, the stress of everything. So Well, Indiana is closing its OptumServe COVID-19 testing sites at the end of June. The sites, of which 31 remain, have provided more than 541,000 free tests since May of last year.
The Indiana Department of Health says it's ending its contract with the private company because of a robust community-led testing network that's now in place. There will still be more than 250 COVID testing sites statewide, with locations in almost every county. In a statement, State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box notes that demand for testing has significantly decreased. The current average number of COVID tests per day in Indiana is about 13,000. That's down more than half since just 1 month ago.
Lindsay or Doty, should this be seen as a positive milestone as the state continues to deal with COVID-19?
I think it's certainly a positive milestone. Does this mean the pandemic is over? No. You know, I think there are other positive milestones that we've had along the way. People being able to get vaccinated, vaccines opening to everyone, being able to drop mask mandates in certain places. All positive steps in the right direction. But none of them individually equal pandemic over. So I think we need to keep that in mind. And, as was mentioned in the piece, there are still more than 250 testing sites open. So it's not that people aren't still getting tested or don't still need to get tested. They do. They are. We still have people testing positive. We still have people dying from COVID. We still have people in the hospitals. So it's a sign of there's less testing being done. But not over yet.
Yeah, to that point, in terms of impact of closing these sites at the end of June, given how many will still be out there, and given how much less testing we've seen over the last couple of months, is this really going to make much of a difference in the overall scheme?
Probably not. You've got 250 sites still open around the state, or will have after the Optum sites close. I mean, the question is going to be, as it has been all along, what do you have in the rural counties? If you're down in Scott County again, or Washington County, where you've got lots of area and not many people, can you get to one? Do you have to drive half an hour to get to the nearest site? That's something that I'm sure they're going to be paying attention to. The fact that it's in pharmacies and in clinics and in lots of places that it wasn't when this contract was signed to begin with, I would think that this is basically good news.
Yeah, there's still a need for some COVID testing because, to Lindsay's point, the pandemic's not over. It's gotten a lot better, but it's not over. So are we worried about, because to Eric's point, a lot of the mobile testing sites that the state utilized throughout the pandemic to find and reach those areas where there wasn't readily available testing around the corner were a lot of times through those Optum sites. They would shut one down for a day and say, okay, we're going on the road. With that kind of gone, are you worried at all that even if we need less testing, we're not going to have testing available to some of the places that still need it?
I'm not worried. I mean, I think, 14 months ago when this started, the state really had to step in and, we didn't have PPE, we didn't have tests, all these kinds of things. And so it made total sense. But that demand is now gone, as we have seen, as you mentioned. You've got pharmacies and all kinds of other places that now offer testing, and there's more and more testing coming online. So I think even in places that may have fewer options, we'll still have access and potentially increased access as other organizations have testing.
Yeah, the state invested a lot of money, I think federal money, but the money it was supposed to spend, on getting testing options to local communities, really boosting those up instead of a state run, mm-hmm. the local run. So is this an inevitable and ultimately positive move?
Yeah, I think it is. And I would what I would hope is that rather than having the concern about how far you have to drive to be tested, it's how far you have to drive to be vaccinated. And that these people would step up and realize that they have a duty to the community and their neighbors and the people who can't have the vaccine because of pre-existing conditions or young people, go in and get the vaccination that will get us to herd immunity. And have the problem of testing go away. That's what I'd like to see happen to get a handle on the pandemic.
And certainly there are a lot of vaccination sites, including mobile ones, to reach
some
of those communities. So hopefully people take advantage. Well, finally, this is a bit of a weird one. UFOs have been in the news of late as government officials increasingly acknowledge UFO sightings by military aircraft, though they're quick to stress that they are not alien sightings, just flying aircraft that couldn't be positively identified. Still, a thing I got in my inbox today, that hasn't stopped a sports betting site from setting odds on the first celebrity to be abducted by extraterrestrials, with Tesla's Elon Musk the odds-on favorite. Of course, you're assuming he's not already an extraterrestrial. And Delaney, if you had to choose a Hoosier politician that was most likely to be abducted by aliens, who would you pick?
I'd pick Todd Rokita, because they could spend years trying to figure out how that brain works.
Who would you pick?
All dangerous answers for me. I'll pick a libertarian.
There you go, a libertarian. Aaron?
Kyle Walker and Ed Delaney, the host of Andromeda Week in Review.
Ooh, that's a good answer. I will put a caveat on Todd Rokita in that he enjoys being out in the spotlight and talking a lot.
That's
so
true.
That may be something that gets their attention.
There you go.
But I will also, I will say it is not an approved betting sports betting option
that's
in
true.
Indiana
that's
right
true.
Now.
That's true. And you're all assuming Bruce Borders hasn't already been abducted. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, Eric Berman of WIBC, and Lindsay Erdody of WFYI. If you'd like if you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.